Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Bald Move Pulp movie. We're going to be talking about the 1986 Dark Muppet classic Labyrinth, starring David Bowie and Jennifer Connelly. This is a commission podcast. Kevin Mann and his fabulous wife, Courtney, commissioned this podcast as a joint commission. This movie is directed by Jim Henson. It's produced by Eric Rattray. But it's weird because everyone talks about George Lucas being the producer behind this.
He's an EP, yeah.
Executive, okay. But also he, I guess, didn't want to steal his friend Jim Henson's thunder. So like he was at a remove from his project, didn't do press for it, etc. Screenplay written by Terry Jones, again, starring David Bowie and Jennifer Connelly. And that's about it. And a bunch of Muppets. Frank Oz shows up. As a wise old man Muppet, I had never seen this movie before, so I'm approaching it as a 44-year-old man. However, I remember the reason I didn't see it is because my mom was a religious nut job, and she forbid me to engage in anything that depicted magic, and also probably David Bowie. You know, that's not sure. That's not Christian. Yeah. Just his presence in a film is affront to God. But my cousins were all ate up with this film. They really loved this film, and I did not know what I was missing. Jim, what's your experience with Labyrinth, and what did you think about your experience with it in 2020?
I'd say 90% of my experience with the Labyrinth is growing up in the 90s and David Bowie's crotch in this movie just being a hilarious internet joke. Because that's what it was, right? Like, maybe my first experience with Labyrinth was seeing a GIF online of like David Bowie, and you zoom in to his crotch, and another David Bowie comes out, and it's this infinite zoom into David Bowie's crotch. That's like,
I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, it's the majority of my experience with Labyrinth. Although I have seen it before, this would probably be. Not much, though. Like, the second time, maybe third time I've seen this movie.
What was the circumstances of your first seeing it? Just you got bored one day and like, you know, I'm going to check out David Bowie.
Seriously, it was, what the hell is David Bowie wearing in this movie? Let me go watch it. And that's it. That's it. And I was a big David Bowie fan of his music, obviously. And the Labyrinth soundtrack was, you know, it's not the best David Bowie, but it is decent David Bowie. That As the World Falls Down is kind of a pretty song. I don't know. And
dance,
you know,
baby, dance baby dance,
his pants magic pants, his junk magic junk. I had to go check out whatever the hell was happening, you know, based on the music that I'd heard too. So
yeah. So what did you think, what did you think when you saw the movie, or what did you think when you saw the movie this time? Like, what's your overall impression?
I think this is a bad movie that has a cult following because it is extremely creative and has a very over the top flamboyant David Bowie in it. That's what I think.
I'm curious about like exploring this concept of it's a bad movie. Cause I really liked this movie. I thought the plot is kind of ridiculous, but it's also literally a young girl's dream. You know,
yeah, she's journeying into womanhood.
This is a coming of age film,
a hero's journey
from an intensely female perspective, and I think that really throws a lot of people because a lot of the commentary that I saw regarding, like, oh my god, David Bowie's sexuality in the juxtaposition of this children's entertainment, I'm like, I grew up watching Carrie Fisher's tits flop around on the Death Star, no bra, and then her in the third movie, literally dressed up as a pleasure slave. For a thuggish space worm, and this is fucked up. Like, I don't know.
The only
like,
reason this is fucked up is because David Bowie is older than her, right? Like, significantly older than her. That's why it's fucked
up. That's true.
But it's what it's trying to say is not fucked up.
Yeah. But I mean, that's like saying it's fucked up that Jabba the Hutt's a 900-year-old space worm and Carrie Fisher's just 20 something. You know, like But like it wasn't a surprise to me when I was reading, because I read a lot of people's experiences and like nostalgic experiences of this movie, and I read a lot of women's nostalgic experiences with women and our nostalgic experience with this movie, and you know, that it there's not an inconsiderable number of girls that grew up watching this movie and had some kind of awakening with the character of Jareth, you know? And again, like I, that didn't seem surprising or sinister at all. It's like it's going to get you somewhere or another, you know, whether it's Carrie Fisher lounging on the pillowy belly of Jabba the Hutt or Jareth juggling his crystal balls in your face and dancing with you after ate his magic peach. It's gonna at some point between the age of like 8 and 14, you're gonna figure out what does it for you, and it's probably gonna be an episode of Star Trek: Next Generation, or Fraggle Rock, or The Rescuers. I don't know what it's gonna do it for you, but a lot of people this did it for them, and I didn't. Yeah, I read some bizarre takes how this is an analogy to like date rape. Or like this is a woman dealing with a childhood sexual abuse trauma, which the parts are all there. You can make that argument, yeah. But
like you can make a lot of arguments how this is creepy in a lot of different ways, and I don't think you're necessarily wrong. But if you look at it, I think from the perspective of 1980s filmmaking, it's not far out of the ordinary, and the ways in which it's far out of the ordinary are actually good. Like to have a female protagonist and the story, the hero's journey through the female lens, is something that is not explored nearly enough, you know, as in that era by people who are treating it with a actual deft hand, deft touch, because like
right.
Pretty in Pink, 16 Candles, like those movies are there's something in there that the young girls can appreciate, I assume. But
of course,
but there's also a lot of shit in there that's just wrong and weird. And so I don't know, the ending of this movie makes me feel so much better about everything that came before it. Because her decisions that she makes at the end are very much her own. She's going to define her own terms here. And that to me makes like redeems the rest of the film.
Yeah. And then I think I mean, like I said, the parts are all there. But like the final place where this movie ends, which is, you know, this has been her fantasy the entire time. She's fully in control. It has no power over her. Like, I guess, again, like, if this is problematic escapism for girls, like, what the fuck is Weird Science, you know?
Oh, God.
Also aimed at teenagers, where dudes are creating a sex simulation out of a laboratory. Like, come on now.
Yeah.
But what I took away from this on my first time watching is just being kind of amazed at the inventiveness of the set pieces and the performance art that pulled them off. Like there's this tunnel of hands thing that I just was literally like, I can't believe I'm watching this. Like these people making puppets out of 6 or 7 hands wearing gloves coming together and the light hits it. And the like
Hoggle,
Hoggle
as a creature, as an animatronic mask, is incredible.
We're talking about Andy Serkis being this perfect blend of technology and performance. Well, Hoggle, man, like is a dwarf actor wearing this incredibly advanced prosthetic that had like 3 different puppeteers working at facial expressions. I think it is really amazing. And there's just scene after scene of just like endless creativity. And since it's all practical, it all still holds up. Like I'm like wondering if I'd seen this movie, I'd been nearly as impressed of Indiana Jones: The Last Crusade's forced perspective, because this movie does forced perspective like every 5 minutes. Like, oh, this is a boulder. Oh God, it's David Bowie's face. Yeah. You know, this is an impassable wall. Actually, it's a shortcut into the labyrinth. It, really like it opens with what's attempting to be a photorealistic CGI owl in 1986.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to see it in glorious 4K transfer because it's a free movie on Amazon Prime. If you haven't seen it, or if you want to see it again and you're an Amazon Prime member, I know a lot of people are, check it out. It's a free movie, 4K even. Looks great. Yeah. Do you want to, like, I guess we should probably check in with Kevin and Courtney to see, you know, they're again, are the ones we give thanks for this movie. They commissioned it at support.baldmove.com. It's one of the options there. They have some commentary and a personal connection to this story that I thought was really interesting. I've been listening to you and Jim for a while, Kevin begins, and it's helped direct my entertainment intake for the better. I generally find that my tastes align with yours, and you've pushed me to watch stuff I've never heard of, but found that I couldn't live without. Cheers to that, and the world is a better place with you guys in this darkest of times. Well, thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
It's very kind of you. As for the movie Labyrinth, it's certainly a childhood favorite of mine, so there's major nostalgia, like Goonies, etc., but it's also gone well over with adults that I've shown it to in the recent past. It is for sure an oddish sort of movie. It's got the direction and puppets of Jim Henson, somewhere in the land between Muppets and Dark Crystal, and the movie of David Bowie. I think he wrote the major songs, but I didn't do a whole lot of, or he didn't do the whole background soundtrack. There's apparently a whole history behind Henson trying to get a major musician to play the role of the Goblin King, but as much as I love the movie, I admit I don't know much about the production lore. Anyway, it's certainly a trip to see Muppets interact with David Bowie, who clearly didn't wear a dance belt and has a junk visible for most of his scenes. Perhaps a fun drinking game, definitely something to keep track of.
Whew.
Also, and that's the thing is, like, I was, the first couple scenes, I'm like, you know, everyone talks about David Bowie's crotch. I'm not seeing it. And then Dance Baby Dance came, and I'm like, okay, I see it. And now I can't unsee it. Oh, God, it's another scene. Another scene.
Oh, yeah. He just, all he does is he's wearing the same tight pants. He just changes the colors of them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I the other thing is, like, I don't think that bulge is natural. That's an accentuated bulge. That's a Batman Forever bulge.
I think so.
I've seen one. Yeah, it didn't look like it moved realistically. Yeah. Yeah. But I don't know. It could, maybe I'm wrong. It also for sure planted Jennifer Connelly as a major crush for my preteen years that has persisted to this day. Obviously, I didn't see her in Labyrinth, but I caught up to her in Career Opportunities and have been a fan ever since myself. Hmm. Oh, you've not seen Career Opportunities?
No, huh?
I saw it in, I think we rented it a couple months after, and like there's a scene where she rides a dime store horse. You know, you put a penny or a dime and the thing just kind of jiggles.
Mm-hmm.
I had no defense against that.
Did she go ass to ass with it? What's...
She did not. Okay. She did not. She went ass to saddle, Jim. Jesus Christ.
All right, because that's that where I know her from is Requiem for a Dream, where, yeah, she does a lot of stuff in the movie.
Yeah, it's a tough one as a Jennifer Connelly fan. Mm-hmm. As for a dedication, here's one. Today is my 1 year anniversary with my fabulous wife, Courtney. So this is, I think, 6 to 8 weeks ago. So happy belated anniversary, you guys.
Yeah, congrats.
We both love this movie and have used some of the background music for our wedding ceremony. Nothing majorly themed. We're not that hardcore. Didn't do a full on goblin themed wedding, huh? We did, however, early in our courtship, both dress up in drag as David Bowie and Jennifer Connelly, a picture included for funsies. And I, through the miracle of OBS technology, am going to go now to that media so people can check it out. My outfit didn't pan out very well, but she won best king at the party, so it turned out pretty good. Anyways, the movie is important to both of us as we are both obsessed with it as children and adults. Combine that with our love for your podcast, and it's an easy commission or easy sell for a commission, even if you don't end up liking it. Fortunately, we end up liking it pretty good. Questions. I don't really have any questions other than your guys' organic take on the movie and its place and time. After having listened to the recent Fellowship of the Ring podcast, I would like your take on the practical effects in Labyrinth. They aren't big budget and are for sure older, but I think there's some very cool uses of practical effects for the time. It makes for a very realistic environment, even though there are puppets everywhere. The non-practical effects don't look great, but it's an old movie, so oh well. I guess there's some themes to consider, including Bowie seducing a younger, underage woman, but it's not super important to the film, and I think the whole point of it is a coming-of-age story for a massive theater nerd in her early to mid-teens. It spoke to me even though I was a boy, not at all interested in theater and fantasy at the time. It still resonated with me somehow, and it hits a lot of the 80s themes while standing on its own quirky and bizarre work. The strong female lead also resonates with me as I grew up loving movies with them, such as Alien. It even has an evil stepmother, but she's only got one scene, so not really that important. Other than that, I want to hear what y'all think of the movie. After all, it's Bowie, Connelly, and a shitload of puppets. cheers, guys. Keep up the good work, and please don't go out of business or I'm going to die. Well,
oh no,
that's a lot of pressure. It's a lot of pressure other than just sustaining your own family. We got other people riding on us too. Courtney chipped in and said, I don't have a lot to add except for my childhood is really formed around this movie. You'll notice Jennifer says, not fair a lot. And I started doing it similarly as a kid. My dad didn't get the connection, just thought I was being a brat.
Yeah.
And every time he gave you a chore, you should have said it's a piece of cake so that he could artificially inflate the difficulty of the chore and give you less time to do it. There are a bunch of other small things from growing up about this movie I could go on about, but I'm super curious to see what you guys think. Kevin alluded to this, but you are the reason why we gave The Leftovers a second try, and it's hands down my favorite show ever.
Wow.
So thank you for that and all you do. Lots of praise there, Jim.
Yeah.
And I love it all. Thanks. We really appreciate you guys supporting us with the commission. So let's get into this. How do you want, because like my normal structure of movie reviews where I talk about the art, the characters, the plot, you know, the themes and all that stuff is a little bit jumbled because I feel like the plot in a very real sense does not matter.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
in
it's,
this movie.
Like you mentioned, this is all just a fantasy in her head, right? It's a dream. It's her grappling with her subconscious and the issues of going from childhood to adulthood. So yeah, the plot essentially is figure that shit out. That's what it is.
I will give a summary if people haven't seen it or maybe you're confused about what we're talking about. Jennifer Connelly is a 16-year-old girl. Her parents have gone through some kind of messy divorce. There's a stepmom in the picture. There's a new baby brother she has, Toby, which is currently taking a lot of time and attention from her. And, you know, she's also busy doing teenage stuff, and now she's got this baby brother to care for. And she is studying to be in a play about this goblin king, and she incorporates a lot of that lore into, you know, her fantasy life. And one night she wishes that her baby brother could be stolen by these goblins and taken away from her. And lo and behold, David Bowie, wish granted, comes and steals her baby brother, and she has 13 hours to rescue her baby brother from the goblin clutches, or I think presumably the baby will turn into a goblin and live with them forever.
Yeah.
So that's the plot, but like this reminds me of that Drew Carey game. What is that part? Wasn't Pardon the Interruption, something else?
Oh, just choose your own adventure. Whose line is it anyway?
Chutes and Ladders. Yeah. Whose line is anywhere? Like the game's made up and the points don't matter. Like, do you have 13 hours or do you have 7? And are of those 7 going, how many of them are going to be consumed in a fantasy ballroom sequence after you've eaten a magic peach? You know, the thing, it's all trying to get to the center of a labyrinth. It's a elaborate series of illusions and whatnot that you have to battle through. It does feel very dreamlike. It's all themes and imagery. So I guess one of the things that I wanted to talk about or spend the most time talking about, the thing that I found the most fascinating was the different effects and how they pulled it off.
Yeah,
you wanna,
for sure.
You want to like exchange amazing shots and talk about it for a little bit, or do you got something else in mind?
Yeah, I mean, let's do that and then we'll get to other stuff. You mentioned the helping hands earlier, which is kind of the tunnel of arms and hands and stuff she falls through. At one point, and that was pretty amazing. I watched a little, it's not even really a documentary, it's like a 3.5-minute scene on YouTube of them sort of behind the scenes practicing that stuff and coming up with it and inventing, because there's like, I don't know, 10, 12, 15 different types of faces they make out of those hands.
Yeah.
And they talk to Jennifer Connelly as she's kind of like, they grab her and like hold her in this tunnel and ask her where she wants to go, and you know, they're trying to help her, but they're making these faces with their hands. Like, you know, you'd make like an alligator or whatever, right? And like,
yeah,
or hand puppets of some kind. And
sure.
I was just super impressed with the creativity of the diversity of the faces they make with their hands.
And how it's not just one person doing like a hand trick. It's like three different people, 6 hands all coming together you know,
to make one face.
Like, these hands are all spaced equidistantly, like a foot from each other on the wall, and like a spotlight hits them, and they all come together and seamlessly form a face, which mouth and eyes and sometimes nose and ears are animated separately by the various puppets, but it all works together. Like somebody's working the mouth, somebody's working.
Yeah.
And you're right. It's not even just the one type of face. It's like recognizable face characters that you could probably give names if you wanted to.
Yeah.
I thought that was like an amazing just kind of piece of performance art. Like I would watch that shit on a street. You know, like street performers, I'd throw money into that hat.
Yeah, I mean, aside from David Bowie's crotch, that was the thing that amazed me most in this movie. Is just that coordination and that, you know, that timing. Like the same thing goes for Hoggle, who is, you know, a mask that's strapped onto a little person, and the mask is animatronic, and they've got four people operating this mask in sync with each other and in sync with the actor who's on set wearing the mask. And I don't even know, like, the amount of time, it always boggles my mind when I see effects work like this, and I'm just thinking, man, the amount of time invested into some of these shots, which may only be a few seconds on screen, is insane. Like, how long do you have to rehearse and practice and get to know each other's movements and each other's timings, and figure out, you know, not only what you want to do, but how you're going to do it.
Right.
I'm blown away by that stuff.
Yeah, it's a dance like anything else. And the amount of skill. I was reading an interview where Henson was making this joke about, like, they joke in Hollywood, you don't want to work with, like, children, animals, or puppets. And he decided to go for the trifecta of pain because...
Because
some of these shots required like a coordination of all three, and yeah. I imagine it was like herding cats. Like if the puppets got all their shit together, then, you know, the dog's looking in the wrong direction, or the kid's crying or not crying as it was, and it must have been a real frustrating, thing to shoot. Like some of these elaborate dance choreographies with that dance baby dance sequence has Bowie, 40 some puppets, like six other adult dancers in costumes, and you know, they're doing green screen work, all that stuff, and it was pretty seamless. I was amazed. I also think that, like, just the puppets themselves were very inventive. They always had these, like, there's all this, like, this duality of stuff, like these two headed shield dudes,
yeah,
that were, like, you know, had an upside down version and a right side up version. I thought that was really cool. The two door knockers that one was deaf and one was dumb because of where the door knocker was going through their ears or their mouth. Some of the Jarrett transformations, there's some that were kind of janky, like when he was going from Al to human and vice versa. It's like they just threw up a bunch of sheets. Like they took Bowie's wig and some sheets and threw them up against the black screen and then kind of like... rotoscoped it into an owl. But when he transformed from, like, I think the wizened old figure into himself, I thought that was like a legit cool transformation. It's probably just Bowie standing up from underneath a puppet, but it looked cool.
I think it looked very cool. Yeah. I like those door knockers a lot. It's I think a pretty easy effect, right? They just put this latex plasticky sort of thing on the outside of a door, and then someone stuck the hand in the mouth to grab the knocker itself. I don't know. It's the super creative stuff like that, where they blend the scenery with the actors who are controlling the puppets. I just love that stuff. And yeah, you know, you don't see it anymore.
Yeah. Some of the stuff was like really cool and inventive in like a Julie Taymor kind of way. Like this trash witch that she encounters after she breaks out of the ballroom illusion, which is literally kind of like, I think, representing her childhood holding her back.
Yeah.
You know, like, look at all these discarded toys and the things you used to love. And aren't these important to you? And don't you want to, like, stay here? Or do you want to keep going forward? The design of that is just really amazing. It felt very adult and the right amount of creepy. Like, I think one of the reasons I grew up to be such a horror pussy is because you're supposed to, as a child, see movies like this. They're kind of like training wheels for, like, look at these scary things, but it's fake and it's and they can't hurt you. And I like skipped all that until I was an adult and I had to.
Yeah.
It's like, imagine, you know how babies, like they fall and skin their knee and they cry for like an hour and they can't get over it. And then as an adult, you do that. If I had never scraped my knee as a 40-year-old man and I did it today, I'd probably cry like a baby. It's just, you know, you got to get used to certain noxious stimulations, I guess.
Yeah.
But I thought that was really cool. This goblin gate, I don't even know how they did it practically. The two sides of them, I'm sure it was like a bunch of trick photography and whatnot, but like it's like you have like this big metal golem looking thing that's embedded in two halves of the gates, and when the gate slams shut, it comes together and animates and then pulls itself off the wall and starts walking and kicking ass. Like a lot of times I can see the seams, like you go that one little like one, the jump or the stutter, because I don't have things exactly lined up. It's like when Luke is activating his lightsaber in the first Star Wars. A lot of times you can see, well, that's Mark Hamill, and then Mark Hamill standing at approximately the same spot with an actual lightsaber, and like everything kind of jumps. I rewound and I could not find the frame at which it jumped. Like it was like meticulously planned out so it all came together. Fuck, it could entirely be a practical effect, like two sides of a suit that
thing,
come
man,
together
with Henson. I don't even know because like this, I don't know, he's so good. That studio is the best, hands down, no pun intended.
And they're doing like just weird shit that like I didn't like. What is an army of ambulatory rocks look like? I'm not saying like rock monsters, like actual rocks.
Yeah,
I now know what that looks like. This is like some Warhammer shit, like goblins dressed like in these mecha suits with machine guns and stuff. Like, it's got a lot of really cool set design and character design, and they just pull it off with a ton of panache.
And I like that that door, the gate golem or whatever you want to call it, because it's sort of a puppet within a puppet, right? It's like. Mm-hmm. It's being puppeteered, but also it's got a goblin inside of it controlling it, so it is itself a puppet. I don't know. I thought that was a cool meta layer.
I heard that the guy, it was actually Kenny Baker, who was the performer for R2-D2, that's inside that little like mecha robot.
Okay, I was wondering, because I saw his name in the credits, and I wasn't sure what he did.
Yeah,
because of Warwick Davis is in this, Kenny Baker's in this, like all the people from Star Wars.
I didn't. That's the one, because Frank Oz played the little wise old man puppet. Which
did he? Nice.
Yeah, he's typecast, man. Once you're Grover, Yoda, you gotta be the wise old man.
Apparently, Warwick's just one of the Goblin Corps. So
okay,
not a named character.
I got an uncredited appearance for you. One of the chief choreographers of this movie is Cheryl McFadden, who will later change her name to Gates and appear as Beverly Crusher.
Really?
And she's one of the costume dancers in the ballroom scene, too.
What?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. That's amazing.
Yeah. 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 There's all kinds of little fun cameos when you start going into the credits and some of this, you know, behind the scenes stuff. Yeah, like, and then there's the one scene that I thought was really amazing conceptually that didn't quite pull off is the M.C. Escher, like, staircase. I thought some of that stuff was very obviously composited and blue screened, and it just didn't work as a sequence because ultimately she just falls out of it, and it does a lot of things go that way where it's like, oh, how's she going to get out of this? Oh, it just is going to blur transition to someplace else because it's a dream.
I thought maybe the weakest of the scenes was the Boggins or whatever, the Fieries, I think they're called. That seemed like a dance number for the sake of dance number. Compositing is really, really bad on them, so there are a lot of like thick matte lines around the edges of those characters. It was fun, and it's a fine scene. It's just like, I don't know. They might have wanted to leave that on the cutting room floor.
We went through the whole movie seeing Jennifer Connelly believably interact with these Muppets in real spaces. Like, you know, Ludo is a really cool Muppet with a full body. You know, it's essentially I forget what the monster is, and it might even be just be called the monster in the Muppet Show. But it's like it's a big person wearing this full Muppet prosthetic, and he looks cool, and he's really there. And you've got all these different. You've got Hoggle. You've got all these other minor goblins. You've got Sir Didymus, and we've seen her interact with all these puppets. And then you get to the fire gang.
Yeah.
And they're just all really badly composited, you know, obviously tiny Muppets that they wanted to be the size of a human being. And how do you do that? And it just, yeah, like, man, you were selling us on the reality of these Muppets. And now it just all kind of comes crashing down.
I like the idea. I like that their heads, you know, their body parts detach.
Yeah.
And like, I imagine like puppeteers with sticks holding all these different body parts and bouncing them around. I could see how it'd be fun and cool in the ideation stage. But man, once you get the result and you see that, I don't know. I might have been tempted to cut that, honestly.
I wonder, I bet this is had to be a huge influence to Guillermo del Toro, right? Like,
for Pan's Labyrinth?
For a lot of the shit that he does, because okay. A lot of the stuff he does is essentially Dark Crystal Muppetry.
Yeah,
you know, like a lot of stuff in Hellboy was like that. Obviously Pan's Labyrinth, but like, I wondered in particular the scene where the fieries take their eyeballs out and use them to look around. I'm like, oh, that had to have inspired the Pale Man, at least some extent in Labyrinth. It's really, really cool sequence. Even like little stuff like you've got up in our view screen for the live chat, but like David Bowie juggling these magic crystal balls that have some kind of magic power to show fates and alter things. And I guess it's the Goblin King's primary way of making his magic happen on the world. Just really, it's just some David Blaine close-up juggling, contact juggling work. Also, it's not even David Bowie doing it.
That's incredibly disappointing.
Yeah, one of the choreographers on the film, Michael Motion, was a talented juggler, and he just crouched behind David Bowie and stuck his arms through through Bowie's armpits and was doing all the ball juggling.
I had this image of David Bowie in his trailer staring into the mirror, juggling these balls, practicing his songs. Like,
yeah, or he just knew how to do that, you know?
You're right, because I could buy it.
Do you want to talk about this song? Because like, this wants to be a musical really, really bad. And it's like almost gets there. Another two songs, and I think it would have. Unfortunately, I think most of the music is ridiculous. Like, there's an opening David Bowie song that's utterly forgettable. There's a Dance Magic, which is kind of a banger as far as catchy, but it's ridiculous in the terms of like where it appears in the plot and in the film.
Oh, yeah.
And like none of the lyrics fit like the mode or tone of these things. There is the Fire Gang song, which, you know, it's fun. It's kind of like a weird white guy Rasta Hakuna Matata type of deal.
Yeah, feels maybe the most Muppety of all the songs.
Yeah, it feels like it could come right out of Fraggle Rock, you know. And then you got the world, or As the World Falls Down, the ballroom scene, which is a pretty good, what do you call that? Not an opera.
Ballad?
Ballad. Yeah, it's a pretty good Bowie ballad. And then you've got the credits song. I think these two actually got a musical release. The As the World Falls Down and Underground actually got videos and like play on the radio. Mm-hmm. But I thought the Underground, it was pretty forgettable David Bowie too.
Agreed.
It needed another song or two to actually become a musical, and I almost wonder if this would have been better had they just jettisoned the musical stuff. Because also, the set runtime, you get in a song, it's got to be like 3 or 4 minutes, right? You can't just like bail on it. I felt like this movie was also a little bit long. And if you took all those scenes out, just turned them into speaking roles, or just axed them all together in the case of the Fieries, I think you'd be right in that like 80 to 90 minute kids movie sweet spot. And this movie, not that it goes down bad, but like that, it just, the movie kind of grinds to a halt in these musical scenes, and you don't want that in a musical.
Yeah. No, this whole movie feels like a showcase for Jim Henson, like, and David Bowie. David Bowie wanted to do something, you know, on screen, very weird in a sexual way, and he did it. And then Jim Henson wanted to do all these puppet things because that's what he does, and he did it. But the movie itself, I don't feel is very good. Like, I don't look. I like Jennifer Connelly. I don't think she's any good in this movie. I think she's a bad actor in this movie. I think the writing doesn't help her at all. Those early scenes are god awful when it comes to writing and acting. It gets better. I think, like, as more of the Monty Python comes out of Terry Jones' writing, it gets better when he gets to these weirder characters where he can, you know, lean into the comedy and the Monty Python-ness that he has. But everything else, like all the serious parts of this movie, are they just needed a few more iterations. You needed to do a little more work on your acting and a little more work on the script, and I think you'd be there. But
it's funny, I forgot to mention the flying circus pedigree of this film, Terry Jones. I read that, so Terry said that, like, he had this really funny kind of romp of a movie, and Henson wasn't too happy with it, so he hired a couple other writers to kind of, like, punch it up, and then Henson realized, like, oh god, I've got the kind of dark tone that I want, but now this movie is, like, completely devoid of joy. It'd probably come off like if Julie Taymor made a kid's movie. It would be fucking scary and weird. And they hired Jones at the last minute to come back and, like, okay, try to add the jokes back, but it was a fundamentally transformed and darker piece. And he's like, ah. So the movie does feel a little piecemeal. Like, these are individual set pieces that work as they in their terms of their own logic to kind of hang together. But as a narrative, I mean, the narrative is essentially right is wrong. What seems to be the good choice is often the bad choice. You can't rush towards things, and you need friends to win.
Yeah,
because there's a couple points where it's like, it's all very subtle, but like that worm in the beginning that you think kind of screwed her over and says, oh, if she went this way, it would have gone right to the castle. Well, Sarah shows up at the castle 15 minutes in the movie and she gets her ass handed to her. She needs she needs the friend Hoggle. She needs the Sir Didymus. She needs especially Ludo. My God, not only is he a beast in combat, but he can summon rock monsters also to fight for you, too.
Yeah.
All that stuff is required. One other thing I want to talk about is the Bog of Eternal Stench.
I love it.
That's right out of early Rick and Morty, man. It's
sure.
An asshole swamp.
Yeah.
Like if the tree roots looked like giant testicles, it would literally be Rick and Morty. It's just a 5 minute long fire swamp, except for instead of fire, it's farts, and instead of rats of unusual size, you got Sir Didymus, the asshole fox that is just barring your way for no good reason.
Yeah, the thing that gets me in that scene is the jiggling. Like, there are, like, pretty clear assholes in the bog, just, you know, spewing.
Galore.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Tons of sphincters. But the jiggling, like, the jiggling is what does it, and it's, you know, it's in this bog, so it's sending up not even mist, it's just like, you know, as it jiggles, there's water and gross. It's disgusting.
Yeah, I got a lot of Fleshlight by Way of Bad Dragon kind of vibes from the latex and the silicone, like you said, jiggling.
Yeah,
it's pretty gross. And I just love Ludo, like, he's like the whole time, like, this bad smell, gotta go, this is all bad vibes, I don't like it. It's I love Ludo, man. Ludo, Ludo's my guy. What else? Oh, as far as I thought, the other thing is clever, and I didn't get this because obviously this is something that you'd get on repeat watches, but they set up literally every scene in that initial pan over Jennifer Connelly's bedroom. Like, you see, and I guess this is where I wish they'd leaned into. They're going to make this movie longer. They had this backstory of, like, David Bowie is an actor that kind of stole away her original mom. Like, she left the family to go be with him, which puts a whole other spin on, you know, the sinister male figure in her life and her, you know, defeating him. But there's, like, a picture of him and her, like, mom kind of pinned up somewhere in a scrapbook. You know, Sir Didymus is a doll in her bedroom. Sir Didymus' mount is essentially Merlin, her dog.
Yeah. There's a fiery doll. There's this statue that I would love to have. It's the statue of the Goblin King of Jareth.
Mm-hmm.
You see it later in the movie too, and it's glorious.
I bet you can buy it. I bet there's a McFarlane replica of it or something.
I need to go look it up.
I bet there's tons of Labyrinth merch actually, with how nostalgia works and all that.
And the whole thing, there's also a bunch of fairy tale books and fantasy books and stuff, Wizard of Oz and things like that.
And a poster for the play Cats, baby.
I saw that. She's a theater nerd. That's fine.
Speaking of horrifying Muppets.
and there's a Labyrinth too, right? Like one of those things where you spin the knobs and it tilts the board and you guide the ball through it. But it's really fancy, got the garden hedges. Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought that was cool. And I don't know. The whole thing is those books are sort of the framing device, I guess, for the whole thing. It's it's a fantasy, but also it's told in that storybook kind of way, like The Neverending Story or Princess Bride, where that's the framing device, which I guess was pretty popular around that time.
I guess that's one of the wings. It's one of the things I wanted to say to you is that you said this is a bad movie, but is this movie worse than Neverending Story? I guess I haven't seen Neverending Story. I think me and Jack watched it when he was five. That's almost 10 years ago.
It's been a long time.
And I remember thinking when I watched it, I don't know how much of this stuff holds up. Great for 5-year-old children.
Absolutely.
But
when I say it's a bad movie, I mean the writing could have been better. The acting could have been better.
Sure.
Stuff like that. Everything. And it feels like it was a Jim Henson project that he just wanted to do a bunch of cool puppets in, and they bolted everything else onto it.
Yeah.
But ultimately the message of the movie, I think, is good. Mm-hmm. The creativity, the effects, all that is pretty amazing.
I want to talk about the baby work, because that's something it always bothers me when babies are screaming on, because I'm like, what did they do to that baby to get this performance? And there's one in particular. There's a scene where the baby is trapped in a pit of goblins that are kind of jostling him around from goblin to goblin. And he's just this kid screaming its head off. Looks like he's terrified. And I'm well, come on, Jim. What'd you do to this child? What'd you do? And there's some big Cersei energy in some of Jennifer Connelly's work with the kid in the early goings of this movie. Mm. You hear Cersei tormented poor Tyrion and made him cry and scream. Jesus Christ, what'd they do? Just twist this kid's nuts?
Yeah.
apparently, this kid loved the puppets and was endlessly fascinated. And in fact, the only way they could get that reaction is they had to wait until the kid was so tired and so badly in need of a nap that the child had a meltdown.
Jesus.
In the middle of these Muppets, and they film it for a minute or two, and then presumably they let their parents comfort him. I don't know.
They keep him up for 4 days in a lighted cage with loud heavy metal music playing. What kind of torture are they doing to this child?
Man, I feel like baby performances are just inherently problematic.
Yeah.
It's non-consensual labor and emotional abuse that is kind of borderline for people to sign up to it. Alan Rickman getting dropped and, mm-hmm. whatever the fuck Kubrick put Shelley Long through. Is it Shelley? No, Shelley Duvall through. Duvall, yeah. Yeah, you add all that maniacal dictator energy and you apply it to children, babies. I don't know. I don't know.
There's a perfect opportunity here to make a human baby puppet, right?
They do
you got
it with
100 other puppets. Just do it.
They did it with Merlin too. It's like Merlin's a real dog, but when they need him to emote, he turns into a puppet. So if you just need a baby chilling on David Bowie's knee, but you need a baby to cry to turn him into a Muppet.
You got
the language of this to take care of it. And then I don't have to worry about this kid growing up and be scarred years later.
So apparently that baby is, what's his name? Barry Froud or something. What was Froud's name? First name?
Yeah. The guy that collaborated with Henson on The Dark Crystal.
And on this movie as well.
Production designer. Yeah.
Apparently that's his kid. It's a Froud baby.
So at least he directly profited it into the proceeds of his abuse somehow.
yeah, that makes it better. Yeah.
Indirectly, I guess.
Money was made. commerce was achieved. So everything is forgiven.
It went to its parents at some point. Probably trickled down. Yeah, sure. That's all fine. And Bowie, man. I would love to know the exact line they went from switching the baby from a real baby to a latex doll that Bowie proceeds to just throw around this set, because this baby is halfway to shaken baby syndrome before they switch to latex. I know, but I'm not sure exactly which acrobatic that Bowie was doing with his baby that was real and which one's not.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that was wild. What else? I want to talk, I guess, maybe some of the characters here, especially Sarah. Like, there's like really cool details, I thought. You know, in the Goonies, like they all have like their little deal. Like, I guess Data is the primary one who's got the jaws of life and he's got the slippy shoes and all that kind of stuff. I like some of the mundane, like, you know, what would a teenage girl have on her? Lipstick. How can she use it? Pretty inventive. Yeah. She uses it to keep track of where she's at in the labyrinth. Of course, the labyrinth has ways of dealing with her cleverness. But I thought that was all really cool. The fact that she's very smart. Like, I think you're supposed to understand that this is a pretty lonely kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, reads a lot of books.
Does a lot of LARPing.
Does a lot of LARPing. You know, enjoys mind-bending M.C. Escher paintings and labyrinths and whatnot. But she's very, very smart. And I liked how they actually use her brains. Like, there's a couple of logic puzzles that she has to solve. The one with the door being guarded and one guy always lies. I still have a hard time wrapping my head around...
Yeah,
what
so
kind
they.
Of Monty Hall shit is going on here? Do you,
I couldn't like, tell you. I certainly couldn't get it as fast as her. Maybe if I sat down and like flowcharted it, I could. But no.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. But, you know, she's recognizably a child. She talks like a child. She's always whining about things not being fair. This piece of cake motif, every time she says the words piece of cake, it pisses off the labyrinth and it just gets harder.
Yeah.
There's also like, you know, there's like she doesn't always, she's petulant, you know, she treats her little baby brother poorly. And that's also, I think, comes across in her initial treating of like Hoggle, because she just flat out bullies Hoggle into doing things that gets him in trouble. But it's like, again, she's on the cusp of like being a kid versus being an adult and like figuring all these things out. I thought pretty nice, like set piece morality plays there.
Yeah.
Speaking of Hoggle.
How much do you think they know? They're like, okay, you do screen tests in any movie, right? You do screen tests where you get everybody, you get the puppets out there on the stage and you shoot a couple of shots, test the lighting. You get David Bowie into his hot pants and you stick him on stage and you have the Hoggle puppet walk right up to him and he's at mouth level with David Bowie's crotch. And you're okay with that in the screen test? You're just no problems whatsoever. This kid's movie, we've got Hoggle right next to Bowie's Hoggle. Not a problem. Everything is good. Roll action. Let's do it.
Hoggle's facial dimensions are so, he's got this... very prominent Pinocchio type nose. Like, is he going in for a dock? Is he going in for docking? Like,
he's got to be.
Yeah, it's it's weird. It is. Yeah, that being right at crotch level was.
And a couple of times they do a close up of it, and I'm unnerved by the whole thing, the whole proposition.
Yeah for sure. One of my favorite things is noticing when people like almost buy it. You know. Like when they're like trip and stumble, but the camera keeps rolling. Like, I love it when the stormtrooper hits his head in the Death Star door. Yeah, I love it when like there's this, me and Cecily were spotting this stuff all the time in Dark. Like when these kids are running through the woods, the real life woods, like a lot of times it's like, someone's like, man, you just broke your ankle, kid. I don't know how you walked that off.
Uh-huh.
Ludo almost boffed it on that rickety ass rock bridge that he was crossing. Like most extreme elimination style. Like, this guy in the pub, you can tell, like, I guess the only way they could see is there was a tiny remote camera mounted in one of its horns and there was a little view screen in the creature's belly that they could look through. And this dude is hopping from rock to rock. It looks slick as hell, and you can actually see his little puppet feet slipping and sliding and barely, like, because you fall on that. Ludo falls in the bog of eternal stench. Filming's done for the day.
Oh, yeah. Like, bring out the second Ludo suit if you got one.
Maybe
other
if you
than
got
that,
a second one, and yeah. if you fall again, then you're done. Like, it's going to take all day for that thing to fall. That you got to clear the bog stench from the electronics and whatnot. Like, it's got to be a high pressure situation. I wonder if they rigged him with wires, so if he slipped, he actually wouldn't fall.
Yeah, I would hope so.
Yeah, damn, that was some high stakes stuff I was seeing. But yeah, if you've seen this once or 100 times, look for Ludo jumping rock to rock, and like I think at the first or second, he just about eats it hard.
I had a question for you because I legitimately don't know what's going on. There are a ton of chickens in this movie, mostly in the Goblin City, mostly in Jarrett's, like, I don't know, castle quarters, whatever he's got up there. Any idea what the chickens are about?
I have no clue.
Okay. No. Yeah, I just was curious because I didn't come up with anything either, but they're everywhere.
Goblins eat them?
Probably, yeah. I assume.
I think interview, it might have been with Jones, but they were talking about like one of the things that they tried to bring out or hint is the fact that in the Goblin Kingdom, everyone is kind of an emotional island unto themselves. Like, you are not supposed to need anything from anybody else. You never need support. You never need help. You never need, like, the idea that you can have friends or people that rely on you in the goblin world is anathema.
Hmm.
And I wonder if there's, like, you know, they had these, like, chickens run around because, like, goblin society wouldn't farm.
Yeah.
Goblin society would, like, they have to have this kind of things run around that could pop in their mouths and eat to sustain themselves.
Could
and maybe they're trying to, that there was maybe some scenes that they hint to that later. I don't know. But that's the thing. This movie does feel hacked together because I do believe it was, both at the script stage and the filming stage and the editing stage. There was like three different levels of like hacking things and moving things in and out. So Jareth, there's a couple of singer actors that were vying for the part. Michael Jackson, Prince, Mick Jagger were considered, were Jim Henson's favorites that he was looking for to do Jareth.
Wow.
Actually, he wanted Sting. That was his number one get.
Okay.
It was his kids, Jim Henson's kids, that convinced him, no, what you want is David Bowie. David, I can't imagine this movie with anybody else. Like, Michael Jackson, first of all, yeah, no. Michael Jackson, like, not
right
only
out.
Would it not have worked in the time, but, like, every decade after, it would have just gotten weirder and weirder to think of him as Jareth.
Yep.
Prince might have been able to pull off Jareth, because he's got that kind of otherworldly weirdo energy.
Mm-hmm.
But Bowie, man, he looks like a Goblin King. He's the only guy that can kind of pull off that costuming and wig. He's got the two-colored eyes, which I knew that David Bowie had two different colored eyes, but I did not know that, you know, that there's that the condition called heterochromia. That's like, you know, he actually doesn't have it. He's got two blue eyes, but he hurt his eye when he was 15 years old, and his, I think, right or left pupil can no longer constrict. So it's always just full open, big black circle.
Oh.
And because of that, it causes it that blue eye to look like a brownish or a ruddy color. So he's actually got two blue eyes. It's just one is like you just only see the little, and it's such a black that the difference it comes across as two different colors.
That sounds
but
painful.
It does give him, yeah, and he probably can't see for shit out that eye, especially like close up.
Or when he walks from like into the outdoors from his house or something, he's probably gonna be blinded.
Yeah, it's like, gotta be. And I actually, because once I found that out, I started looking for like articles where him talking about that like ever being a struggle, but he only ever mentions it as a boon. Like, I like it makes me look, it gives me my mystique, I thank my mate, because I guess it was him and his 15-year-old buddy fighting over a girl and he got his like eye gouged really bad. He's like, I always thank me mate for giving me my mystique. And that's exactly how he sounds. I did my best. How can I talk like a Goblin King?
You just gotta talk like Laszlo. I feel like both Matt Berry and what's his name, the New Zealand comedian,
Taika Legion. Waititi, you're talking?
No, in Legion. In fucking Legion. Flight of the Conchords.
Yeah, I know who you're talking
about.
That guy.
God, something J. It starts with a J.
Jerome.
Jesus Christ. No, that's not it either. Both of those guys have modeled their performances, their entire careers after David Bowie.
Yeah. That's not incorrect. Jermaine Clement.
Jermaine, yeah.
It's a J word name, but it's not. It's like Jareth. Not Jared. It's Jareth. It's Jermaine.
They both desperately want to be David Bowie, and that's fine. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with wanting to be David Bowie. He's amazing.
But no, I think he's a really good. He's just an interesting like kind of fantasy foil for this young girl because he's got this like really sinister androgynous kind of energy. He can be threatening.
And when he's introduced, that first scene when he comes on the stage and the glitter just goes everywhere, it's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's funny because like he's also polarizing because when I was reading people's reactions and there's like a pretty split between people that found him very off-putting and weird and people that thought that they made him feel funny things in their crotch region.
Yeah.
And I think that's fair. That's the reaction Bowie provokes in people.
Sure.
What else do you want to, I feel like we, like I said, I'm not afraid to get a social issue between my teeth and worry it a little bit. But I just really think that, some of the overblown hysteria around David Bowie being a almost 40-year-old man and Jennifer Connelly being 16 is like only interesting in the extent that like they had a real life romance, which they did not, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, she's 14 like, in this movie. She's supposed to be 16, but the actor is 14. Yeah,
interesting.
Not that it makes any difference. Like the message of the movie is what matters.
Yeah, yeah, and I like, you know, like if I mean, maybe if you're rounding to the third act, like on pins and needles, like I don't know how this is gonna go. Like the fact that she completely asserts control, and you know, realizes that she's the one that's in control of all this stuff is happening, and is kind of empowering. It's like I don't know how that concern survives the contact with the end of the movie. And like I said, if you're like really concerned, like I do think it's, you know, there's a lot to say about society's double standards about women and men and how they come of age and how we see sexuality and things like that. But like, I don't know, this movie feels pretty innocent in the true sense of the word, you know, like this is a child's fantasy, not worried about whether it makes an old person comfortable or uncomfortable.
Sure. No, I think that's valid. And also it's, you know, in order to have a believable story, sometimes you got to show scary things. And I think like that's one of the scary things for this young girl that they're trying to show is the seductive man who the older man who might want to take advantage of her. Like that needs to be in there so that when she says, I don't need this, I get to determine this for myself. You have no power over me. It's actually overcoming something, right? It's not like, oh, this was my choice all along and now I'm just stating it. No, it's like,
right.
I wasn't sure if this was my choice and this was a scary thing that I was grappling with. Now I've realized it's my choice.
Yeah. So, you know, I didn't grow up as a teenage girl. Other people can have different interpretations and feelings about it. But like, yeah, it seems like it's, it's just funny because I was reading Roger Ebert's review and it clearly something that really bothered him. And then I was reading his reviews of other like male oriented teenage coming age fantasies and like none of that concern is present. And I'm just like, I love Roger Ebert, but never forget, he's an old ass dude.
True.
with maybe uncomfortable, you know, raised in Catholic school, maybe an uncomfortable relationship with his own like sexuality and, you know,
I mean, he's
what that meant
in that Roger Corman era of
right.
You know, raunchy filmmaking. It's like, you know, he's not a bastion kind of purity.
Likes big titties, but like also like, you know, what does that mean? Like, and also I'm an old man. I'm still I'm still noticing like, I don't know. Maybe he's gripped up about that kind of stuff too. But
and I think you could do the same thing, the same movie just with a boy and it would make just as much sense, right? Like these are issues of the transition between childhood and adulthood, not necessarily a young girl to a woman.
Yeah, and like I said, I was thinking like Goonies explore, but like a lot of that's age appropriate, you know, like Sean Astin fumbling with his brother's girlfriend. They're only like a year or two apart. It's not a big deal, but like, the Weird Science is the one that I kept on thinking about when I'm like, it's like, this is a movie pitched at teenagers, and what is it saying about fantasies and what's healthy and what's not? And I'm like, did you guys live through different 80s than me? Like, holy fuck, between Princess Leia and Weird Science and all, it's like, it was like, I don't know, like the toxic levels of horniness, but, I thought this was a real fun. I see what all the hype is about. I can only imagine, you know, seeing like some of this stuff in the days where these special effects are cutting edge. Like all this, a lot of the practical effects, like we've talked so much before, absolutely hold up. All the force perspective stuff really holds up and is super cool. And it's worth watching just for that reason, you know? Yeah.
And that David Bowie and watch face.
And put Labyrinth on repeat and it'll be a good time, I guarantee you.
For sure.
Anything else we want to talk about, or?
No, I think I'm good.
Yeah, I feel like we got in and out of Labyrinth, quick adventure in and out, less than 13 hours.
This movie was not a financial success in its day. It had a budget of $25 million, made about half that back at the box office, and didn't win any awards. So,
how did this not win effects, set design, production design? Like,
had given that all to the Dark Crystal. I don't know. And
do you know what? I read that this kind of broke Jim Henson, like, in a very real sense, creatively, financially, like his spirit. Like, he felt very rejected by the public and Hollywood, because this is kind of his baby. This is like a story he wanted to tell. He really liked his collaboration with Froud. What is this? Froud? For the Dark Crystal, and you know, he wanted to tell something wholly original, and when it didn't, and this was not a huge budget either, like what is it, $20 million,
25, which
in the mid 80s was not still like blockbuster territory. And it, you know, didn't make that make it back, not even close. So that's kind of a bittersweet part of it too. Thank you very much to Kevin and Courtney for commissioning this film. Really appreciate your support. If you would like to commission your own film, it's super easy to do so, or any two-ish hours of media. Honestly, it doesn't have to be a film. All you got to do is go to support.baldmove.com. There's an option to commission podcast. You go there, you put in your money down, and then we'll contact you and do the rest. Thank you very much for commissioning. I hope you guys enjoyed this. I hope you guys continue to rock on being Sarah and Jareth for the rest of your long, healthy, and happy life. We'll be back with another movie real soon. I'm not sure what it's going to be next week.
It's Return of the King. It might be
Return of the King.
Yeah.
I've been starting my research this week on it. We actually flipped the order because like, I'm like, I gotta do justice to the King, man. I can't half-ass the King. So, it'll be out next week if all things go to plan, for another Bald Move Pulp movie. But until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
We'll see you on the next one.